Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I am Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. A lot of people treat politics as a sport. How dare they? Sports have rules. But the closest analogy, I think, is to the NFL, because in the NFL, there's a week of buildup, and you think about the games, and you worry about the games, and then all the games are played on one day, on Sunday, and you can't even see them all. And it's just like that with politics. If you're like me, if you're a political junkie, and I know a lot of the listeners to this show are, you're really interested in all the races, and then everyone's having a debate on the same night or within the same week. And then you look in the paper the next day and you say, oh, man, West Virginia governor debate was last night. And I didn't even get to see it. I need some sort of political version of the red zone channel so you could see all the scoring plays. Well, to help us dissect what's going on in political races, we have two guests. Nate Silver of 538.com, a pollster, a prognosticator, a numbers cruncher extraordinaire. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Mike.
How you doing?
Good.
And Melinda Henenberger, who is the founder and editor of Politics Daily. Hello, Melinda.
How are you?
Good. So let's go to California first, because here we have, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Jerry Brown is leading Meg Whitman ever so slightly in the race for governor. And there was recently a debate. What are the big issues at play in that race, Melinda? How do they differ from the issues we're seeing everywhere? Jobs, jobs, jobs.
They, too, are talking jobs, 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 but in this last debate they had, the big topic was the fact that one of Jerry Brown's aides had been caught on a cell phone call in the background with Brown calling Meg Whitman a whore. He did not mean in the sense of the world's oldest profession, but he meant as in pawn of big business. And I think Brown made a mistake in the debate by when the debate moderator said that women, when they hear that word, feel much like African-Americans do hearing the N-word. Brown said, I completely dispute that comparison, and anyway, we've apologized, which didn't strike the right tone. But as you say, he's pretty far ahead, 43-49, I think, was the latest. And has been ahead pretty consistently in the last few weeks.
And we actually have a short clip of what Meg Whitman said about overhearing the word whore, and here's that from the debate.
It's not just me. It's the people of California who deserve better than slurs and personal attacks.
Obviously, this is I wouldn't want to call it a gift. It's an insult, but Meg Whitman's going to make a lot of hay out of this. But is there indications that it's really a big issue to Californians, or is it just the, you know, kind of slight dust up of the moment, Melinda?
It may be the latter, but I don't think it's – I personally don't think that it wasn't – it didn't have to be as big an issue as she made as Brown let it become.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he could have dealt with it much more artfully. He should have apologized much more than he did. I mean, to say sort of angrily that you've already apologized doesn't really convey what he should have been getting across. I mean, it is certainly a gift to Whitman because it diverted attention from her Nannygate situation.
Right, which is the revelation that she hired an illegal worker who
she knew, according to the woman, didn't have her papers, which was turned into a bigger issue, mostly because the night before the news came out, she had said in an earlier debate that, you know, the whole problem with immigration were these terrible employers who knowingly did this awful thing, and then the very next morning it turns out she was probably one of them.
Now, Nate, I'm going to talk mostly about polls to you, but chime in on any aspects of politics or anything else you want to talk about with this race. But my question to you is, do you have any way of knowing how much Jerry Brown has this lead, small lead, but a lead that is outside the margin of error in most polls? Do we have any way of knowing how much of that is what Jerry Brown is doing right as a candidate and how much of that is just that California is still mostly a Democratic state?
Well, it's hard to say. You have kind of these rapid-fire events occurring. He seemed to have been picking up some momentum in the polls about a month ago. They started to kind of tack his way a little bit. I think the Nannygate thing maybe did hurt Meg Whitman some, where it went from being kind of a one-point Brown lead to a 5 or 6-point lead in a lot of polls. you know, I think it kind of got her off track a little bit, and she was a candidate who has a lot of money and was former CEO of a famous company and, you know, was used to kind of controlling the message, and I think that maybe knocked her off her game. But, you know, Brown's in a position now where, you know, you'd call him the favorite. I don't think you'd call him the heavy favorite yet, but that is one race that's broken toward the Democrats.
And in terms of controlling the message, it's easy to control when you have Meg Whitman's fortune, and she has been absolutely blasting the airwaves with a number of ads, and here's one of them.
Jerry Brown's good old days. But what really happened?
CNN, not me, CNN says his assertion about his tax record was, quote, just plain wrong. Jerry Brown went out there and took credit for the fact that the people of California voted for Proposition 13, which lowered taxes, which he opposed. And now he's going around taking credit for it. He raised taxes as governor of California. He had a surplus when he took office and a deficit when he left. He doesn't tell the people the truth.
So that, if you couldn't tell, was the Meg Whitman campaign using Bill Clinton from a number of years ago to attack Jerry Brown. And Jerry Brown answered with an ad indicating that every time Meg Whitman lies, her nose grows bigger. And yes, they used the slide whistle sound effect that we all love from political ads. So how about the ad spending, Melinda? Has it been doing, has it been a service to Whitman? Has she been doing well because she could take out so many ads? Or, like we're hearing some in Connecticut, are people getting sick of the number of ads?
Well, she's been a record $119 million at last count of her own money. And I don't know, Nancy Pelosi had a line yesterday. She said, you know, if Meg Whitman had a story to tell, the $19 million would have taken hold by now. I think a lot of voters find it very satisfying when the big spender doesn't manage to spend his or her way into office, and it does not seem like these ads are finding their mark. With the Clinton one in particular, then afterwards Brown made a disparaging comment about Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, and then the two made up, and all of it did not seem to stick.
What kind of candidate has she been? Because I expected her. I mean, before she ran for office, she seemed a fairly charismatic CEO. And I know she's, as the head of eBay, had to address business conventions and, you know, do a lot of public speaking. But she does seem a little more robotic than I thought she might be.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, on the one hand, compared to some of these other political neophytes we're seeing across the country, she's extremely polished. She does not embarrass herself in any way in a debate. But on the other hand, she has this sort of low-risk, low-yield strategy of sticking very closely to her talking points. She repeats her commercials.
Yeah.
Which, you know, leaves Brown very well prepared because he knows the answers to all that. And he, in the main, because, of course, he's been in this game his entire life, comes across as just much better prepared and also much more engaged. She can seem a little chilly, I think, whereas he, you know, is in there kind of sweating and going for it.
Right. And this is Mike Pesca on WNYC, in for Brian Lehrer, and we're speaking with Melinda Henenberger and Nate Silver about the races. And, Nate, one last question about the California race. Is this one of those races? I think the polling indicates that even though Brown has a lead, he's still below the quote-unquote magic number of 50%. And you did, well, actually, this would be talking about incumbents, but you did a big expose on the idea that if incumbents are below 50%, maybe a lead for that sort of incumbent isn't like a regular lead. What'd you find out about that?
Yeah, I mean, you'll hear this a lot, that an incumbent is going to lose the election if he's not over 50%, and it turns out that's not true. Looking at the margin between the candidates is still the most important thing, but you do want to look at the number of undecided voters, where in California people have generally made up their minds, and that's part of what makes it tough for Meg Whitman. Only 5 or 6% of the state doesn't know how they're going to vote, and they would basically all have to vote for her to win, and sometimes that happens, but she's maybe a 3-1 or 4-1 underdog now, I would think.
Right, and of course, Jerry Brown's not the incumbent. Arnold Schwarzenegger is. He's attorney general, but he kind of plays as an incumbent, given that he's held that position in the past. Let's go to, now, Melinda, you mentioned the a more or less polished political newcomer. Let's go now to Nevada, where Harry Reid is battling Sharron Angle. And Angle, I think, might fall into that category of a not-quite-polished neophyte. What's she been doing on the campaign trail?
Paul, I watched their debate last night, like all our fellow junkies, between Reid and Engel, and I was very surprised by the coverage of the debate, where I thought she seemed to be hanging on by her fingernails. I mean, she was very rough. She was sort of careening from wall to wall with internal contradictions in her answers. I mean, saying healthcare, you know, government should get out of the healthcare business, and then complaining about cuts in Medicare. She suggested that she never said that unemployed people are spoiled or that it wasn't a senator's job to create jobs. And then she, again, she said she never said that, and then she repeated that it was not a senator's job to create jobs. My jaw dropped when she said, "Man up, Harry Reid."
That charge wasn't like some personal thing. She wanted him to admit that Social Security was broken. Man up.
Correct.
And admit that.
Correct. No, it was a pre-planned line.
Yeah.
And yet the coverage of her was very positive. It sort of reminded me of the coverage of Bush Gore in 2000, where because expectations of Bush were so low, every time he performed, even semi-serviceably, he got a big ovation, I thought.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I read an article by John Ralston, who's a great political writer.
Right, I did too.
And here's how he opened it. Let's get the easy part out of the way. Sharron Engel won the big debate. Engel won because she looked relatively credible, appearing not to be the Wicked Witch of the West and scoring many more rhetorical points. And then he quoted all these other people on Twitter saying essentially the same thing here. He quoted Chuck Todd of NBC saying, "Reid's problem tonight is that while Engel wasn't great, his performance made her look passable." Nate, what do you know about this? Because we have this like triple deke here where there is the actual expectation, there's what the pundits think the expectation is, and then the pundits weigh in not on who won, but if they think that people's expectations had not been met. What's going on here?
Well, you know, I know anyone who's watched Harry Reid for the last couple of years would think that he's exceptionally charismatic either. But, you know, but sometimes the way the media perceives a debate doesn't match how the public sees it. Sometimes also the way the public sees it is affected by the kind of media narrative and so forth. I mean, you know, I'm not sure this matters all that much. You know, Nevada is another state where it's like they're not going to decide, but it's going to come down to turnout, I think. But, you know, it probably doesn't help Reid to have not looked very kind of statesman-like, I suppose. But I agree with both of you that, you know, sometimes the media kind of lines up to one side, and, you know, there are different expectations. I mean, you know, some people thought that Sarah Palin, for instance, won her debate against Joe Biden, and the public did not. The numbers
right.
did not kind of break in her favor, McCain's, at all.
I thought that, too. I mean, where Palin would say, "Well, I'm not going to answer your question, Mr. Moderator. I'm going to answer the people's question." Many of the pundits seemed to say, "Oh, good technique," but I think the people said, "Wait, you didn't answer the moderator's question." Well, what about Christine O'Donnell's debate in Delaware, Nate? Did that seem to hurt her in the polls? Because polling has not done well for her in general.
She's not going to win, but I thought she actually did okay for herself. You know, she's pretty natural in the TV format. You know, she came across as being, you know, at least fairly polished, I think. You know, I thought Chris Coons, a Democrat, was kind of walking a fine line between playing it kind of safe, which is what you do when you have a 15 or 20-point lead in the polls, and not being too dismissive. I thought he did okay, but, you know, the problem for her is she might gain 5 points, which would be a big bounce, frankly, for any kind of senatorial debate, which most people don't watch, and she'd still be 10 points down, so it's really going to be difficult for her.
In general, the role of debates then are way overplayed by the media, Nate?
I don't know. Not presidential debates. I mean, presidential debates get, you know, 80 million viewers or whatever, and they really can make a big impact, but I don't think most people are watching, are going to watch a Senate debate, and other people who do watch, not that many are really undecided, are going to be swayed by new things they learn about the candidates.
This is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Melinda, we talked a little bit about Christine O'Donnell and Sharron Engel. If both of those candidates lose, is it a real blow to the Tea Party in that these were supposed to be states that the generic Republican should have won in, the polls were telling us, that both of those Democrats, well, in the case of Nevada, it was an incumbent. In the case of Delaware, it was an open seat. But both Democrats probably should have lost. The Tea Party candidate won, and now they're both in trouble. I mean, Nate says that in Delaware, you could write off Christine O'Donnell. So does it Do those two races, when you add them up, say, send a message to the Tea Party? Don't, you know, you're harming regular Republican politics?
I think that we don't know yet the answer. Whatever happens in those two races, you have to look, and of course I don't think either there's any question about what's going to happen in Delaware, but it look at it nationally. On the positive side for the Tea Party, for the Republicans, they have certainly gotten the enthusiasm going. They will affect turnout, which is what so many of these races are going to turn on, of course. And that, yet on the downside, you are sending a message nationally that some of these people are really extreme, to use Harry Reid's favorite word from last night. So, you know, in the end, will the Tea Party turn out to be, say, in 2012, the president's salvation? Could be, but it's also what's driving a lot of the enthusiasm gap in this midterm election.
Yes, but then again, the enthusiasm, if there was no Tea Party, wouldn't it just be regular Republican enthusiasm? Like Newt Gingrich didn't have to start his own party to have the contract with America, but the Republicans were enthusiastic back then.
Yes, but I do think it's been a vehicle. I do think it's maybe it's chicken and egg, but it's a big part of what you're seeing this season for sure.
Nate, overall, I've been reading some of your writing saying that so much is unknowable, and I guess a lot of times you might think a pundit would say that to hedge his bets, but you mean something very specific by how many races are in flux. Could you tell us what you mean?
Well, you know, in the Senate, you can kind of go down race by race, and it's not that hard to do. You have kind of a finite set of circumstances to look at. But in the House, it's really hard to say. I mean, there are literally somewhere between 80 and 100, maybe even 110 races that were uncertain about. They all have different kind of dynamics. And so to anyone who kind of thinks they can call what the Republicans' number will be within the three-point range is just making a guess, right? They're not being scientific about it. You know, kind of the math and the science says that when you have that many races in play, in places where they often aren't in play, and you have different kinds of candidates, I mean, we're not really going to know all that much until November 2nd occurs. You know, we know it's going to be a big year to some extent for the GOP, but that could mean 30 seats, in which case Democrats would hold the House, and it could mean 70 or 75.
What chance do you think that the Democrats hold the House?
We have met with about a 1 in 3 chance, 1 in 4 chance, I should say, right now, about 25-27% in our last forecast. So, I mean, you know, they would need to kind of gut out a lot of races at the local level or to have this kind of enthusiasm gap so-called closed. There is some evidence that it might have by a point or two, but still, you know, there are also a lot of vulnerable Democratic incumbents that didn't look like they were going to be seriously challenged. And so, you know, the downside's pretty far down. But I don't know. You know, we talk about kind of the media conventional wisdom. It seems to me it's running a little bit ahead of itself now in terms of how certain people are. The GOP will take over the House. They're definitely the favorites. But, you know, a lot of things could go wrong still, and the polling is inconsistent and, you know, isn't always that good.
Melinda, I wanted to, if our theme is, we've established this theme of these political neophytes and how well are they doing, one race that was that is interesting to me is going on in Wisconsin, has not gotten nearly the coverage, and there you have a long-term Senator, Russ Feingold, in serious trouble. He's trailing Ron Johnson, a political neophyte, but Ron Johnson, to me, I don't know if you've watched a lot of the debates or watched him, he seems a lot more polished than Meg Whitman, who has supposedly been on bigger stages, what with her job with eBay. He seems a lot more
right.
polished than O'Donnell or Engel or any of these other neophyte candidates we've been talking about. You want to talk about that race a little bit?
I think that's right. I think that he is one of the exceptions, along with Dino Rossi, who turned in a good performance, I thought, against Patty Murray in the Washington State Senate race last night. Ron Johnson has been ahead, and, you know, Russ Feingold is clearly in trouble, to the point that I saw where recently he said that he was the original Tea Partier and these people should take another look at him because he argues rightly, I think, that he's the true maverick, having voted against the bank bailouts and against the Patriot Act. He was the only one in the Senate to do that. But, you know, it doesn't look good for him. I think that, you know, Russ Feingold, beloved by liberals for holding the line and for not going along with his party all the time, it doesn't look good. He's down 8 points as an incumbent to this guy nobody ever heard of, Ron Johnson.
Nate, does the results of that race surprise you?
You know, if you had asked me a couple months ago, then sure, you know, because Feingold was a guy who did not vote for TARP and kind of seemed to have, you know, avoided some of the votes that made a lot of Democrats unpopular. You know, he's kind of a homespun kind of guy. But, you know, I mean, Johnson is also a candidate who was kind of and inspired by the Tea Party, you know. So there are some very strong candidates they've gotten. Marco Rubio in Florida has been a terrific candidate for the GOP. He's going to win that race most likely in Florida, but
right.
You know,
but it's not like Rubio didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, he led the Florida Senate for a while.
Right. You know, I guess Johnson, and he's run some really good ads too. I think one thing is Feingold's had trouble deciding. He's always been the nice guy in the campaigns, right? And Johnson's kind of trying to out nice him and say, "Oh, I'm just a family guy from Oshkosh or whatever," right? And
he
then,
is
you know,
from Oshkosh,
Feingold seems
yeah.
a little flummoxed about how to tackle that.
If you want to participate in our conversation, please go to the Politics Hub called It's a Free Country. We've got our own political projections map, and It's a Free Country has partnered with Google to bring you an interactive map, and it's at afreecountry.org, or it's at freecountry.org, actually. So, Nate, if the Wisconsin race surprises you or would have surprised you a couple months ago, what else is surprising to you?
I think, you know, one thing we talked about a little bit earlier, but is some of these candidates who have spent a lot of money and are maybe seeing it not come to fruition. So you have Meg Whitman in California. You also have kind of Linda Blumenthal Linda McMahon in Connecticut, where, you know, she was kind of creeping up on Richard Blumenthal, the attorney general there, and creeping up. And then it kind of stopped, you know. And I think sometimes you hit a point where voters are saturated with advertising. Look what happened to Mayor Bloomberg in the mayoral race here last year, where he spent, you know, almost as much as Meg Whitman has, you know, and he almost lost that race when he was kind of way ahead in the polls. So I think, you know, one thing that's tough to figure out is, you know, people mostly watch TV, and that's how they kind of make their decisions about the candidates, and the advertisements matter a lot. But, you know, when you see a surge in the polls, you know, when is it caused by a good advertisement having gone up versus kind of other factors? You know, West Virginia is a state where it looks like Democrats might lose. The kind of popular incumbent governor, Joe Manchin, might lose his bid. People say, we'll keep you in Charleston and not send you to D.C. But now he's had some ads where he's basically literally is, you know, shooting bullet holes in Democratic policy positions, right, and acting very far to the right, and at the same time kind of hitting his opponent on a couple of things. And he's kind of gaining ground in the polls now. It might save that seat for the Democrats.
Right, and it might save that seat for the Democrats, but it might be one of those seats. Great, he gets elected and doesn't vote for cap and trade and doesn't vote for any of the Democrats' platform. So really, what's the point except to, you know, name committee heads?
Yeah, I mean, we know how much Democrats dislike, you know, people like Ben Nelson. You know, I think he'll be a supercharged Ben Nelson where he might, you know, if they're lucky, vote with the Democrats half the time and maybe less than that. He would be up if he won, as would Racy. He would be up for reelection again in 2012, right, because the special election seats and Senator Byrd passed away. And so he's, you know, going to be in campaign mode from the get-go. He won't vote for cap and trade. He might vote to repeal health care. So, you know, that may be when Democrats save and will not be happy about having saved, particularly in a year from now or so.
Well, and in that race is somewhat famous because there was a call out for actors who appeared hicky to wear trucker hats and flannel shirts to do an ad for Manchin's opponent. And my personal take on that ad was the flannel shirts were brand new. It did not at all seem authentic. You could put a trucker hat on anyone. If they don't have the right accent, it doesn't play. And I found this other ad, and this is a race that hasn't been getting that much attention. It's the Texas governor race. And I found this just about the most interesting and in ways appalling political ad I've seen this year. And let me explain the visual. Just picture, as you hear this ad, what we're seeing is a needle going into the arm of an 11-year-old girl. And here's the ad.
This is the arm of an 11-year-old girl. Now, imagine a governor who wanted to take a needle, fill it with a controversial drug for sexually transmitted diseases, and inject it in every 11- and 12-year-old girl in Texas. That's what Governor Rick Perry wanted to do. That's what Governor Perry and his drug company friends wanted him to do. On this issue, we've got one thing to say. Not our daughters, and not in our Texas.
Wow. I don't know if
wow.
you saw that. Yeah, right? I don't know if you saw that ad. And that was a big issue a couple years ago. And it's odd that, you know, the ad says, it's called, his nickname, Daughters. It's said to be for the benefit of the young women of Texas. But what the injection was meant to do, it was about the human the HPV virus, which would prevent cervical cancer.
Right.
So it's hard for anyone watching. Right, it's hard for anyone watching that ad to get the impression that other than Rick Perry wants to inject your daughters with something dangerous.
That ad is not going to work because that issue has been around in Texas for a long, long time. I mean, people were shocked, it's true, that Rick Perry came out with what seemed like a pretty enlightened view of young girls 10, 11, 12 getting their Gardasil shots to protect them against HPV virus,
right,
which is sexually transmitted. But then we found out, oh, Rick Perry has a good friend who's in the Gardasil business. So this issue has been out there for a long time. PolitiFact found this ad. I think they gave it their pants on fire rating. I just don't see it working at all. And, I mean, that is a very interesting race in that I'm surprised Bill White is running as close as he is. He's only about 5 points shy of Rick Perry, who's going for his third term. But Rick Perry has some problems that would make a better ad for Bill White. This week, White is going after him for throughout the campaign. One of his White's big themes has been the charge of Perry cronyism and Perry appointees raising money for him. And this week it turns out that a company that's owned by one of Perry's top donors, something called Covergen, got a big multi-million-dollar award from the State Emerging Technology Fund, even though the screening board had rejected the application. So this comes at a very bad time for Perry, of course.
Yep. Well, I want to thank both my guests for injecting their knowledge into this conversation. Melinda Henenberger, founder and editor of Politics Daily, and Nate Silver, blogger of the New York Times 538 blog. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike.